Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, we're recording this a few days early because I have obligations when we usually do this. So there's no alcohol to talk about right now. There's no wine.
Well, we'll just have to get right to it.
It's very Netflix heavy this evening, or in this episode. We're going to talk about three films that are being released via Netflix. Some of them will have theatrical runs. One's already out in major cities. One will be out soon, but they're all three in the next week or two going to all be on Netflix.
And they are very, very different.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about the first one, and I believe it will be the big, well, let me caveat when I say the biggest. It will win the most awards. It might not get the most views on Netflix out of the three, but it will by far win the most awards, and it just won a very big award. What award did it just win?
It just won the award from the voting body that we belong to, which is the Washington, D.C. Area Film Critics Association. It won Best Picture.
When we say it, we're talking about
Roma. Roma, which I would have preferred it win, which it still did, but I think it is, in fact, the best foreign language film and not necessarily, not even close, in my opinion, to best film.
Some people are saying this may be the year. It's never happened at the Oscars where the foreign film has won Best Picture. It's been nominated before, but a foreign film has never won the Best Picture Oscar. So people are saying Roma's got a chance.
It is a critical darling, but it is not a crowd pleaser, and there is a big difference.
Well, I want to dissect a little bit what you mean by crowd pleaser, because yes, I'm a critic, and I really like this film, so I guess you can put me on the bandwagon of critical darling, but no, like crowd pleaser, like no, you're not. It's not a Marvel film. It's not a superhero film.
No, but it's also not a Star is Born kind of film or a Green Book kind of film. When I say crowd pleaser, I'm saying that I watched this at Middleburg Film Festival, and I would say at least five or six people walked out.
How dare they?
They were so disappointed. It was just not what they were. It was just not the kind of movie that they were expecting to see on opening night at Middleburg. I don't believe it has all that universal appeal. I think there's the potential for discord a la the people who like Shape of Water and those who didn't, and yet Shape of Water won the Oscar. So I'm not saying it doesn't have a chance. In fact, I think it very well could win based on the way the Academy tends to, you know, appreciate the art of a film like Roma, but personally, to me, it was not Best Picture.
Well, even though it is called Roma, it is not set in Rome. In fact, you clued me in on this when I asked on Twitter, what does Roma mean? Because it is set in Mexico, so that's probably the first disconnect for a crowd pleaser. Mm-hmm. It's in black and white. It's set in the very early 70s, so there's probably three disconnects right there. And Roma, as you told me, is a neighborhood of Mexico City. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a year in the life of a family. They're upper middle class. They're bourgeois. They're not super rich, but the paterfamilias is a doctor. The wife stays home, but she's also well educated. But we follow Cleo. We follow Cleo, the maid, the nanny, the do everything girl, and kind of the first half of the film is just kind of her daily routine, very domestic business. We see her cleaning up after the dog. They don't walk the dog. The dog just kind of messes up the entryway all day. She cooks, she cleans, she tends to the children, picks them up from school, wipes noses, wipes tears. And, every now on the weekend, she escapes. She goes out with her boyfriend, Fermin. They go to the movies. They sneak out from the movies, get a hotel room, because that's the only way they can get privacy. And Cleo gets pregnant. And in very strict Catholicism-run Mexico, certain options are not on the table. She's going to have this baby. She tells Fermin, he's gone. He's gone.
He takes off.
So the rest of the film is Cleo dealing with her duties as a maid, her duties as a nanny, this pregnancy, family drama because the father has run off, Mexican society at the time, which we see in the background. There's still a very sharp divide, we learn, between landowners and peasants. Mm-hmm. There's marches and riots in the street. There's the military gets called in and starts murdering some students, we see. We don't really know why, unless you're familiar with Mexico in the 70s, which I am not. I do not know why, and I don't need to know why. I just need to know how it affects Cleo.
Yeah, but I think it helps to know why, and so that's where I think part of the disconnect will come in, is that this is a very personal film for the director, Alfonso Cuarón. It's really part of his history. He very fondly remembers the nanny that his family had and growing up in this particular time period where there was all this political turmoil going on and there was this sort of social stratification going on as well. And so this is Cuarón's real attempt to, it's sort of almost semi-autobiographical based on some of his family experiences. And it's in Spanish. And so I just think that while it's beautifully shot and it has some powerful moments, just overall, it's one of those arty movies where like the opening scene was 10 minutes of just splashing water.
The opening scene was
crashing,
brilliant.
Crashing waves.
There's a lot going on
for 10 minutes
that I don't think you saw.
And water, you know, rushing into, for cleaning the dog poop off the patio. Just lots of water and lots of allegory. And so it's beautiful. And so I was totally going, okay, you know, yes, I can see it. Maybe getting some Best Director nods, cinematography nods, and foreign language film nods. Again, not a Best Picture overall for me, but some people walked out of that film either in awe, just complete awe, or in complete disbelief that they were so disappointed because they were expecting something so different. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of them were expecting a film that actually was in Italian and took place in Italy.
I'm not unhappy that this won our big award. I really like this film. I didn't nominate it. I didn't even vote for it. But I'm quite pleased that it won. I just happen to like, you know, five other films better. Cuarón, who you brought up, is a Mexican director, and he is now one of just the globe's leading auteur directors. We know him from Children of Men. He won a Best Director Oscar already for Gravity. Great film, and all of a sudden just shift genres, shift gears. This is a very, very autobiographical film. It's for the credits say it's for Lebo. Lebo was his nanny, and she's still alive. And he went out to find an actress, an untrained one. He went out to find a girl who looked like Lebo. It doesn't matter if she could or could not act. He can deal with that, and he found her. He found her way down in the middle of nowhere, Oaxaca. He found Yalitza I can't even do it. I'm going to butcher it, but it's like Yalitza Aparicio.
Apararicio.
And she had just got her certificate to start teaching preschool. She was going to become a teacher, and she just showed up with a friend at this casting call, and he took one look at her and like, that's it. You look exact. You're her spitting image. And she's like, I don't know. I'm probably darker. I have some indigenous in me, da-da-da. And I learned in this movie, there's a big difference between the Mexicans who with the European influence in them and how they treat and consider people, the mestizas, the indigenous folk. And she was one of them. She's like, I think I'm too dark skinned for this. And then she saw the pictures like, oh, okay, I get it now. She was like me. And yeah, I really dug this film. I can't connect with it. I didn't grow up there. I don't know, but that's the power of the film. It drew me in.
No, it does draw you in. And this particular first-time actress. I mean, it's hard to even call her an actress because she's really not an actress. She's a woman that they found in Mexico who they put into this film, and she was able to pull it off because obviously there were parts of it that she could connect to with the story. And
there was a very big heavy lifting scene at the end that
she does
pulled off.
She does, and she was at Middleburg, so I saw a Q&A with her, but she was there with an interpreter, and she was given this Rising Star Award. And some people have actually, you know, thrown her name out there for Best Actress, which I think, again, is a stretch. Because I think this is one of those cases where I kind of feel like I need to see her in something else to know if she can really
I don't know
act.
If we ever will. She doesn't have any
I don't
work
think,
yet.
Exactly. I don't think she will. And so to sort of put her in the category of calling this great performance. I'm not so sure I buy that. This is just a film that's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. And so I just think that in some cases it might turn out to be a little bit of a divisive choice if it manages to continue to rack up the awards. Because to me, this is exactly, it's Mexico's submission for Best Foreign Language Film. And I think that's where it belongs. And I think it deserves to win that category.
I'm interested to see how it plays on Netflix. This is a really heavy film for Netflix. People usually, you know, they Netflix and chill. They relax. They watch comedies and garbage. So I wonder if they're really going to take the time to give this a chance.
I don't know. We just had this discussion. I'm not so sure it plays well on a smaller screen. I think people who really want to get the most out of it, who find that they are interested in seeing this the way it's meant to really, truly be seen, I think you're going to be better off seeing it on a big screen, because from a cinematography standpoint, it kind of deserves that.
Well, my last thing I want to say about it is I read maybe this will be in your wheelhouse. I read a criticism on it this evening that I wanted to say. Someone said the film spends, Cuarón spends so much time making her into an angel that she's not really a human being. Remember when she goes to find Fermin and he's doing all that martial arts practice with 100 other guys.
Totally naked? That was a different scene.
In the dusty field. One of the best shots of the film where they're just in the dusty field doing all that, and she does the kind of the foot stand thing. And that's what it reminded me of. It's so busy making her into a perfect angel that she's not really a human being.
See, I didn't feel that at all. I just didn't love this movie, and the story was just not one that really, truly resonated with me on any big level. So I wouldn't have leveled that criticism, because it just didn't I didn't think that much on it.
There's some heavy-handed foreshadowing when they're at the really rich guy's place for New Year's and he sets his vineyard on fire, and you know, she's toasting with mezcal and like, here's to the new year, and she drops it on the floor.
It makes some very strong artistic choices a la Cuarón, and I was not a huge fan of Gravity, so it doesn't surprise me that he just tends to make movies that I don't love for some reason, but
Gravity's for you. It was short, and it had Sandy
and it
B
had
in
George
it.
Clooney in it.
So I'm surprised you didn't like Gravity.
Didn't it kill off George Clooney? Maybe that's what did it for me.
Well, spoilers if you haven't seen that 2013 film yet. But
too bad.
Yeah, we're gonna split on this. I think Roma is just an outstanding film,
and it's not a split because I think it's a very, very good film. I just don't think it's the best picture.
All right, we're going to stay with Netflix here. Oh, by the way, Roma is being released this weekend in major cities, Washington, D.C. being one of them. It will not be on Netflix until December 14th.
So you have 1 week to actually go see it in the proper form. If this is something that really interests you, I say go see it in a theater.
Now, something you can see starting this Friday, December 7th, right here on Netflix, and in major cities, you can already go see this in limited theaters, is Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle. Yes, they did another Jungle Book movie. Remember, just a couple years ago, 2016, Disney gave the Jungle Book the live action treatment that they've been giving their entire back catalog. And it was good. I remember I really liked it. It was directed by Jon Favreau. It was decent. It was solid. So Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle, is not that.
No.
First of all, it's not Disney.
And it's not good.
and it's a different story. You know, I don't know if you did, because I don't think you're familiar with the Jungle Book, but
no.
I am familiar with, you know, the story. You got your elephants and snakes and monkeys, and that's what he does. In the end, he goes to the man village. In this one, they veer off from the story. There's a lot more interaction with the man village, and even men, and discovering humans' weird ways. Mowgli is tough. I'm not sure, Hannah. Who is this
who is
for?
It for?
Who is this
that
for?
Was
is
my
this for
question.
Children?
No, it's way too dark for kids, and it doesn't quite go anywhere that adults will necessarily want to go.
I will not let my 5-year-old watch this movie.
No. I mean, and I think you point out in your review that once you get past like the first half, maybe, then it becomes there's stuff in it that some young kid or teenager might like. But it's so dark at the beginning that it would be really difficult to just get through that and to get past that initial just just a distressing kind of premise.
Well, in the original children's story, yeah, you're in a jungle, and that's the state of nature. Animals, you know, stronger animals eat weaker animals. It's how they survive. It's very brutal. It's cruel. But that's how the world works. And man, do they show you it, Andy Serkis, director Andy Serkis, who he directed Breathe last year, if you remember Breathe.
Which was very good.
And we know him as, you know, he's the motion capture guy. He played Gollum in Lord of the Rings. He played Caesar, the chimpanzee,
Planet
in the
of the Apes
Planet
guy.
Of the Apes trilogy. Mm-hmm. That's Andy Serkis.
I love Andy Serkis.
He made such a visceral, such a brutal. I mean, wolves are killing other wolves, throw them off of cliffs. Wolves are taking down elk. The snake, Ka the python, by far, I think, is the most interesting character. He does some, you know, weird stuff. The monkeys are mean. And the man, there's a hunter in the village trying to kill Shere Khan the tiger. Shere Khan, voiced by Benedict Cumberbatch in that really low, you remember him? He was the dragon in the Hobbit films. He has that really low voice. He's trying to start a war between humans and animals by breaking certain nature laws. And a hunter comes to kill him. That hunter does some stuff. And there's a scene so shocking towards the end, I couldn't believe it was in there.
Yeah, he managed to get, you know, Andy Serkis got some really good voice talent to participate in this film. You've got Christian Bale playing the brother, the animal brother.
He's Bagheera. He's the panther, yeah.
So he's the one that sort of grows up and helps train and raise Mowgli when Mowgli is found as a child in the jungle, as just a baby. And so, you know, Christian Bale's voice is very good in this. But this is two movies within a week that I've seen Christian Bale. So to see him as Dick Cheney in Vice the same week that I'm hearing him as this panther in Mowgli was just a little bizarre. But Christian Bale is, you know, good voice talent. Cate Blanchett's in it. Frida Pinto. You know, really decent actors doing these voices. And I just don't think this film serves any of them all that well. And it doesn't serve the audience all that well. I really just kind of watched it and went, why? We just don't need it.
It's a case of managing expectations. People know the Jungle Book as a musical. You know, Bare Necessities. Baloo and Mowgli, just life's a breeze, floating down a river. Baloo here, voiced by Andy Serkis, is not cuddly looking. Bill Murray was Baloo in 2016's Jungle Book, and he was a cuddly goofball. He was a doofus, which is who Baloo is. He isn't here. He's actually a mean teacher. And he looks really old and crusty, and kids are not going to be like, oh, Baloo, and they're going to take one look at this Baloo and be like, whoa, mama, dada, turn this nightmare off. It is so, like, this is for 13-year-old. I would give this a PG-13 rating.
It is PG-13.
No one's going to watch this movie.
No, but that's the point, is it is a PG-13 rating, and that's why I'm kind of like, I don't get why we need, just 2 short years ago, we got The Jungle Book. I don't really understand why we need this sort of different take on the Rudyard Kipling classic.
This was not filmed this year. This was filmed back when the other one was filmed. That one just got released first. So Serkis held on to it. He knew, all right, I can't release it back to back, so I'm going to wait like 2 years.
He should have waited at least another two.
But he said his goal was to make a dark Jungle Book, and he did. And it's so dark, it's off-putting.
He achieved his goal, but I can't imagine anybody really going to great lengths to watch this. But who knows, maybe we'll be surprised, because again, some people will go into it with very different expectations, so they might be disappointed, but they might go and watch it.
All right, our next film, also Netflix, I do not believe has a theatrical release, but you can, this Friday, December 7th, you can turn on Dumplin'. So Hannah, I want to ask, why is Willow Dean Dixon, well, first of all, who is her favorite musician, her favorite music artist, and what's she trying to do? What is Willow Dean Dixon doing in Dumplin'?
Well, and I'm wondering, Dolly Parton is their favorite artist, and I'm wondering if this might get a theatrical release for like a week just to make it...
It's probably in L.A. for a week.
So that the Dolly Parton original song that's in it could potentially, you know, make it into the Oscar run for original songs. And so that's a possibility.
But what's Dumplin' about?
Dumplin' is about a teenager who enters the beauty pageant in small town Texas that her mother had won as a teenager and now runs as a single mom.
The Miss Teen Blue Bonnet.
Miss Teen pageant. Blue Bonnet pageant. And Jennifer Aniston plays the mom. Very good casting. And Dumplin' is performed, you know, Ms. Willa Dean Dixon. Willa Dean Dixon. And she's this plus-size teenage daughter of this skinny Jennifer Aniston mom character.
Yeah, they do not match.
They do not match. And people might remember, or hopefully they did see, the girl who plays Willow Dean is Danielle McDonald, who you may recall was in the film Patty Cakes.
Oh, yeah.
About a year ago.
It was last year.
Where she was a rapper. She was sort of this, you know, kind of, again, this sort of overweight white girl who was trying to break into the rap scene in, I believe, somewhere in, like, New Jersey. And so this is sort of kind of a variation on the theme of just sort of a misfit trying to find her place and dealing with body shaming issues and that sort of thing and the whole pageant world. And this, to me, is like the Pitch Perfect crowd, I think, would enjoy it. And it's cheesy. It's formulaic. It's absolutely corny. No apologies for that. It's a feel-good movie that is very much like watching a Hallmark movie that just happens to have really good actors in it. And it's based on a popular young adult novel that called Dumplin' that I had never heard of before, but apparently the young adult readership actually has. And it could very well spawn the sequel, just like there is a second book called Puddin'. So I know if you get through Dumplin', you might be interested in checking out Puddin'.
When someone makes a movie about pageants, I first have to look, is this pro-pageant or anti-pageant? And Dumplin' is pro-pageant. It's more inclusive, but it's saying, you know what, make fun of it. It's okay, you can make fun of it. But pageant culture is overall beneficial to the girls. My problem with this is, you mentioned the formula. It's formulaic, and my problem is with the girls, the archetypes. So there's the fat girls. Two fat girls enroll in the pageant. You know, Willow Dean wants to blow up the pageant from the inside. She's very angry. She's angry at her mother, and she's angry at herself. She's just an angry girl. She's going to blow up this pageant. The other archetype are the cookie-cutter blonde princesses. The other archetype is the anarchist punk.
And then there's the good-looking friend, you know, the fat friend and the good friend. There are stereotypes.
The script did not know what to do with the anarchist punk. Like, she just got left in the wind. It just didn't know what to do with her and just dropped her. And she was – I didn't know what they could do with her. There's a sub-plot with a bunch of drag queens. And that was – okay, but they used it more as a joke at the end for a kind of a very religious mother who had to sit by the drag queens. And
oh, I don't know. It was also a chance to really pay homage to Dolly Parton and all and her drag queen fan base and those that would dress up as Dolly and sing Dolly songs. There was a huge – that was a big theme in this film was kind of how Willow Dean, because of the relationship that she had had, like, with her favorite aunt growing up, who basically the aunt has died when this film is getting started. And so a lot of what's happening is sort of dealing with the loss of this favorite aunt who introduced her to all these Dolly Parton songs. And so that's really what triggered this whole thing and really was Willow Dean's biggest fan. And always encouraging of her. And so it's sort of about her trying to find that strength in herself again or through different channels. And so it while it might have all these very stereotypical types of characters, there are no mean girls in this particular film. Mom is not mean. Everybody, you know, people have sort of... you can understand where they're coming from with their own points of view. And it really is just one of those, in the end, message movies that's about embracing who you are and how you can have, and the beauty within and all of that sort of thing. So I think for this young adult age group and for anybody who watches those Hallmark Channel marathons this time of year for the movies, this is right in their wheelhouse. It's a harmless, sweet, heartwarming kind of film to watch.
There is an audience for this film, and it will find it on Netflix. The director, Anne Fletcher, there is already an audience for her films. She did 27 Dresses. Mm-hmm. She did The Proposal.
Both great
so
chick flicks.
This, she's in her wheelhouse. The, mm-hmm. the reason this doesn't necessarily work for me is because the lady who adapted the novel, so the novel by Julie Murphy was adapted by Kristen Hahn, so I looked her up. She's a producer. She executive produced The Departed, by the way, and here she is adapting this kind of touchy coming-of-age pageant moms and daughters novel, and she didn't hit it. She didn't score run here.
No, I get that, and I tend to agree that it's not a home run. I did love movies like The Proposal and 27 Dresses are just are that same kind of theme where it's about, you know, just the message in the end is solid and heartwarming. This did have flaws. It's not a great movie. I can't even imagine seeing it in theatrical release. It really felt more like a really good TV movie to me, more so than what you might see on the big screen. But I think this time of year, it's just an easy escape film that where, you know, nobody gets hurt. And I kind of like that.
Fair enough. Our next two films, we split. I went to see one. Hannah went to see the other. Hers is a documentary. Mine's a standard narrative film. So we'll start with mine.
I still wanted to switch, by the way.
When you're watching Grease, because I know how much you love Grease.
I love Grease.
When you're watching Grease 2 or something like High School Musical.
No, I love Grease. Grease 2 I wouldn't put in that
actually,
same category.
I kind of like Grease 2.
Well, you're older.
When you're watching,
younger.
When you're watching something like High School Musical, do you ever think if Rydell High would be better if half the school became zombies and the T-Birds and the Pink Ladies had to pick up, you know, baseball bats and whatever's lying around and fight the zombies, but still sing songs?
Yeah, because I believe there was a Buffy the Vampire episode that really did something just along those lines that was like the big Buffy musical episode.
Well, I'm talking about Anna and the Apocalypse. It's an import. It's from, I believe it's from Scotland. And these are your normal kids having normal kid problems. You know, they're seniors in high school and they're yearning to break free. In fact, the first song of the film is Break Free. You know, they want to go to college. They want to take a gap year and travel and piss off dad. There's cliques. There's the bully table. There's the hot girl table. You know, standard high school business. Standard High School Musical number. Stand on top of the cafeteria tables.
Fame. If it was my era, you'd be talking about the TV series Fame as opposed to High School Musical.
Well, all of a sudden, and we hear it on the radio, we know it's coming. There's some disease, and nobody knows what it is, but it's hyper-contagious, and we can start seeing the signs around town. People are walking slow and shuffling, and blood is pouring out of their mouth, and they're missing appendages. And yeah, we have a full-on zombie outbreak. Full-on zombie outbreak, and they're going to sing songs about that too. I really got a kick out of this film. I like the songs are catchy. I was listening to the soundtrack before we started this episode, and I was like, "Yeah, these are pretty good songs." The main girl, Anna, is Ella Hunt. I don't think I've seen her before. She is very good. Her supporting cast is good. It keeps you on your toes because people die you do not think will die. That's good because a lot of times it's okay. You can pick them off. That guy's not going to make it because we don't need him anymore, and that girl's going to make it because you just kind of don't know who's going to live and die in this one. So point in favor on that one. Point for the songs. Minus because it got weird towards the end. There's the high school principal is. He goes mad. He goes nuts. And the script didn't need that. There was plenty of other opportunities to pursue here. We don't spend too much time with the zombies. There is major zombie violence. This is rated R. I mean, there's some major violence here. But it doesn't loiter on it. It doesn't do it just to do it. And, you know, but it's doing it because it's advertising itself as, come see the zombie High School Musical. Fair enough. That's a great log line. That will draw me into the theaters. And I hope it draws you. It's a limited release, limited number, art house kind of theater business. I would love Netflix to pick this up. This is the kind of thing that would go viral.
And I wanted to see it. And so is it the kind of thing, though, where all's well that ends well, sort of? Or is it a Charlie ending?
No, I don't want to give anything away, but, you know, it's you know, if you want a sequel, it's there. Like, not everybody dies, but, no, I don't want to give too much away, but I think you would like it. You would cringe at some of the blood,
sure.
But you would sign on to these songs.
I would, and I was all ready to try and go see it. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to, and you should have seen the film instead that I saw.
No way.
Which is the documentary Divide and Conquer, the story of Roger Ailes. And for those who don't know, maybe live under a rock, Roger Ailes is basically the guy who created, with Rupert Murdoch's money, the Fox News Channel. And was single-handedly, in many cases, responsible for a lot of the Republican victories and sort of getting politicians, starting with Nixon, to understand the value of looking good on television and of getting the base riled. He really loved to just get people riled up. And that became his rallying cry. And that's who he was. And he did it very successfully for many years. I learned a lot. It was very interesting. It goes back really to his early days where he was a production assistant on the Mike Douglas talk show. And then there's this really great little story about how when the executive producer of the show was stepping aside, there was another producer that everyone just assumed would be taking over, but that Roger Ailes had somehow gone to Douglas and convinced him that he'd be the better choice. And this guy, this sort of former PA, became the head of the show, and that put him in the eye line of all these famous people. And he just loved being around famous people. And I mean, it just, there's a lot of the Me Too in here for the second half of this film. Basically, Roger Ailes, his career imploded when women started stepping forward and talking about how he had really sexually harassed them at Fox over the years and had basically undermined many careers if these women didn't sleep with him or flirt with him the way that he wanted them to. And it really, it really just kind of showed you how, in that era, you kind of really understand the Me Too era, the movement a lot more, because you get that sense of what was status quo and acceptable among these men in power positions in the media. And there's nothing more ironic than like when you see Roger Ailes being interviewed by Charlie Rose and when you see Roger Ailes being interviewed by Matt Lauer, and it's just, and Bill O'Reilly defending himself out the wazoo. It's very fascinating and distressing, and oh my gosh, I found it interesting but not worth recommending to people unless you really, really like the media history part of it.
I'm never going to watch this because, and it's not because of the specifically, you're right, it is because of the subject matter. I'm tired of the political documentary.
Yeah.
On both sides, you know, on one side you have Fahrenheit 11/9 and The Final Year. On this side you have Divide and Conquer and Get Me Roger Stone. I don't want to watch any of them.
And they are they're telling the same story, because in this one, very much like the way Michael Moore was trying to do in his, is this is all about showing this heavy influence that this one man has had on Republican politics and politicians from Nixon to the Tea Party all the way up through Trump, and how something, you know, how these things come to be, and how audiences and how the Americans are just manipulated and can be manipulated so easily by a media savvy person pulling strings in the back, and you know, that man behind the curtain kind of thing. And boy, yeah, it's just I agree with you. It's like we've seen enough of this, and it's just another one that I'm not so sure that it really, certainly not at the holiday season. It's not one that I wanted to necessarily see. I think I'd rather see zombies.
Yeah, I just want nothing to do with this. I just don't have the palate. in the year 2018 for another political documentary like this.
Yeah, I mean, you absolutely have to just be very interested in understanding the life and times of Roger Ailes, who died within a year of being ousted from Fox. It was so connected to his identity and who he was that it's just interesting that he really did not survive long beyond being booted from a company that he helped build.
All right. This
oh,
was
wait.
Our...
I also think we should make quick mention of who was chosen for the Oscar telecast host.
Oh, yeah. I got it. I was watching a movie last night. No, I was watching Vox Lux back last night, which we will talk about next week. And I got this text from Hannah that says, Kevin Hart equals Oscar host or something like that. And I was like, okay. And I immediately thought, all right, they're going diverse. They're counteracting Oscars so white. And then I saw someone who wrote a joke. Well, they did want to make the Oscars shorter. I hope his first sentence is not a joke. I hope it's an apology for Night School.
Night School. That's what I was thinking. And then I just thought it was brilliant. A brilliant move sort of 24 hours later, even less than that, for the Golden Globes to announce Adam Sandberg and Sandra Oh as the co-hosts for the Golden Globes. And that's a very interesting choice.
Well, if they do a pair, which they have in the past, like Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, they're already two hosts that are connected.
Yeah. So huh. I think it'll be – that one's more intriguing to me. Kevin Hart is
Sandra
sort of
O's
hit
not
or
funny.
Miss. She can be. I mean, she can be wry. She has that wry humor kind of thing going, if you remember, like from Sideways and
well,
stuff like
Kevin
that.
Hart is a risk. He's not divisive. He's not polarizing.
Right,
but
right.
There are those who love his repetitive movies and his screechy delivery. And there's people like me that I have kind of tired of it over the years.
Well, I'm just surprised, I think, at that choice, given how disappointing Night School was. I think if Night School had been some huge hit and had delivered on a very promising premise, then it would have been a completely different story. Or if they had said, okay, we're going to have Kevin Hart and Tiffany Haddish both combined.
He is
co-host.
Funny, though. The Oscars work with a good comedian.
And as long as they keep the telecast shorter and he is reactive, because I do think one of the best hosts are those who aren't so heavily scripted that they don't take the time to pay attention to what's actually happening during the broadcast itself and react for the audience's sake to really what's going on. And so I want him to do well because I really want a more entertaining, tighter, enjoyable Oscar telecast. So we will see.
Yeah, it's not the most risky choice, but it's intriguing.
Yeah.
All right, this was our Netflix heavy episode. We batted lead off with the big WAFCA award winner, Roma. I really, really like this film.
I like it for best foreign language film. I don't like it for a mainstream pick.
Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle is insane. It's the stuff of nightmares for me.
And I just don't understand why it needed to be here at all. So it's not for kids. It's not for adults. So I'm not really sure where it's supposed to fit.
Dumplin' has a built-in audience, Dolly Parton and Jennifer Aniston fans. I enjoyed it. Like, I really did find myself engaged, but the formula annoyed me.
Well, Danielle McDonald is a star in the making, too. I mean, if you go back and you watch Patty Cakes, that's like a hidden gem indie from a couple years ago. Much grittier. But this girl's got talent. She sort of reminds me a lot of Rebel Wilson in the way Rebel Wilson plays her character, like Fat Amy in Pitch Perfect. And so I do think this relatively formulaic, cheesy film benefits from having actors who can really pull off, they're able to elevate that into something a little more than it otherwise might be.
Anna and the Apocalypse is a genre mashup I don't think we've seen yet, High School Musical zombie gore fest, and it works.
And I think I might try and see it, and I do wish that's one where I would like to see it on Netflix as well. And Divide and Conquer, the story of Roger Ailes, what can I say? If you're a Fox News watcher, actually no, if you're a Fox News watcher, you probably would not particularly appreciate this film. If you are a champion of the Me Too movement and are a more of a CNN and MSNBC watcher, you're probably going to get a lot more out of just learning the history of Roger Ailes and the network that he built and how it's managed to survive his passing. So that's, to me, the most interesting thing, is it just shows that whereas Roger Ailes probably thought the network could never survive without him and without Bill O'Reilly, I think one of the most interesting things to come out of this whole thing is that a lot of people still watch Fox News.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.